This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist on the line with me. How are you today, George?
I'm very good. I guess every day feels like a Friday during the world lockdown, right?
and you know, we're in this till the end of the month at least. We don't know what's going to happen after that.
Depends on the vaccination rate and also the infection rate numbers, right?
Yes.
I guess everyone needs to work really hard.
Yes, it depends. We have KPIs now. We need to keep to them. And only then are we going to open up, isn't it? So today, George, we're going to be talking about effective genomic surveillance. And what that actually looks like, right? We know the WHO has now given supposedly neutral names to the genes that the variants that COVID-19 has presented. We used to call them based on the country that it surfaced, but now we have certain generic names, Alpha for the UK variant, Beta for the South African variant, Gamma for the Brazilian one, and Delta for the Indian one. Can you even remember it? I mean, it's going to go on, and I know it does go on. It's just that these are the four most common ones that we're talking about at the moment. But we have on the line with us Dr. Dale Fisher, Professor of Infectious Diseases at National University of Singapore, who's joining us to help us understand genomic surveillance and what that actually looks like. Welcome, Dr. Dale. How are you today?
Hi, Meera. Thanks for having me back. Hi, George.
You know, I just want to ask you, Professor Dale, what's it looking like in Singapore at the moment when it comes to genomic surveillance or sequencing?
The situation in Singapore is we can see light at the end of the tunnel with the pandemic. We've got about 47% of people have had one jab, 34% have had both jabs. That does change the dynamic a little bit. It means that cases and transmission aren't as dangerous as they used to be because we know how successful the vaccines are. But nonetheless, in terms of the genomic surveillance that you're talking about, our numbers are obviously very low. A bad day for us is 20 or 30 cases. And we're obviously able to do whole genome sequencing on all of our cases still. So we can track it. The vast majority of this Delta virus, as you call it, the B16172 from India.
Yeah. And so does that mean what Singapore is doing? They're in parallel to diagnosing, you're also doing genome sequencing at the same time?
Yeah, well, it follows. It takes a couple of extra days or so to get the whole genome sequencing done. But yeah, it helps us complete the puzzle. It helps us link clusters. If we find an individual that's unlinked, then we can do their whole genome sequencing and see if we can link them through the genetics and after that, then try and link them epidemiologically so we can dig out any new chains of transmission, that type of thing. So it's very helpful. It's a wonderful luxury to have.
Yeah. I mean, Dale, have you guys detected any variants in Singapore at all?
Oh, we had a wonderful variant very early on in the pandemic. I think it was February last year, which was quite transmissible, but very very mild in the symptoms that it caused. Unfortunately, it died out because some people criticize our good infection control, and that particular variant didn't take off. But it would have been nice if that had taken off because it was much less severe. But apart from that, no, all our mutations and variants are really imported, and our transmission chains are generally short, so it doesn't get a chance to evolve.
Mm-hmm. Dale, I mean, perhaps for the benefit of the listeners, you can kind of explain a little bit about how these variants occurs and why do they congregate in different countries?
Yep. And sorry, just one more to add on to that, Professor Dale. I think a lot of us mistake variants and mutations. They're two different things. Maybe you just want to add on to George's question there.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Meera. And fundamental in George's question. So mRNA is RNA viruses are by their very nature quite unstable. So RNA is like and DNA is a template from which you can multiply and make more RNA, and you can produce proteins such as the spike protein that everyone's familiar with, that allows the virus to enter the cells. Now, there's not good mechanisms to prevent mistakes. So if there is a very small mutation in the nucleic acids that make up the RNA, then you could get an extra base put in. That's called an insertion. You could get one drop out. That's a deletion. You could have a substitution. So these are all the point mutations that you can see. And sometimes that will translate into, for instance, a different amino acid forming that's created by that nucleic acid base. And then once you've got a slightly different looking protein, then a series of mutations can create a variant which can behave differently. And that's the whole point, is as we observe for these clusters of mutations to cause a variant, does that variant then turn into something that's behaving differently?
Okay. Don't think I got that one. But let's go back a little. We're talking about copying, right? Are we copying when it comes to this whole RNA and DNA process?
Yes.
The templates, they're copying each other. And then when there are errors in these copies, that's where you start getting variants or mutations. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, so we could call an error a mutation. And when you get a series of errors, that could, let's call that a variant then. And it does that variant behave differently because now there's, say 10 or 12 mutations in a new strain of the virus, and does that make it more infective or more virulent, more severe disease? These are the things we look for in the new variants that come about as a result of a series of errors.
Okay.
And series of errors are part of how this virus, how RNA viruses work. That's their survival mechanism.
Okay, so they deliberately make errors. Is that what you're saying? No.
Yeah, we're getting back to down to the origins of life now. But that's how they work. And that's how they survive, and that's how they develop.
Okay.
So coming back to the questions, why do we have these clusters related to different countries?
So once let's say you get a variant, and let's say it's very successful. For whatever reason, it's more transmissible, it survives longer, whether it survives longer in the environment or whether you need less of it to cause an infection. These are the types of things that might see it run away. And that's why we're seeing, firstly, it was the Alpha, the UK variant, became very prolific, if you like, and really expanded across UK and then quickly spread across the world. We saw the same in South Africa with its variant, and we saw the same in Brazil. It has a survival advantage and then just, again, transmits like this whole new cluster. More interestingly, in Brazil, it had a great propensity to reinfect people. So its change in behaviour was that it was able to escape the body's immunity, if you like, and therefore they had a resurge of cases in people that have had it before. So the immunity wasn't as effective.
Yeah. In the first time we spoke, Professor Dale, I think I also asked you about back in the day whether or not the virus was taking on a version which is sort of, it sort of took on a version based on the DNA or the genes of the population. Is that what's happening still? And that's why we have these different viruses taking on different variants in different countries.
No, I'd put it more down to chance. So once you get a whole lot of transmission, once you get a lot more copying, you've got much more chance for errors.
Right.
And then as the errors reformulate into into tens of thousands of variants altogether, really, then one or two of those will pop out as being very successful.
And George, sorry.
I guess with all these variants, what it boils down to on the front line or in the grounds is that, number one, will they be more infectious? And then number two, will they be more deadly? And then number three, will we be equally able to detect them? And then number four, is that how are the vaccines going to work, right?
Yeah. So how important is it to bring genome sequencing into the pandemic fight? Because countries are not doing enough of that. We know India is doing it 0.13% of acceptable gene sequencing rate. What is acceptable, really?
Yeah, so firstly, George has hit the nail on the head. I look at it in three ways. We're looking at transmissibility, we're looking at virulence or severity, and the third one I just call escape more broadly. So it can escape from the ability for the test to detect it. It can escape the body's immunity, whether that's from vaccination or from antibodies that you might be given, or from reinfection. So it's that transmissibility, virulence, and escape. And then, as you were saying, Meera, this is what we must do in parallel, is just keep an eye out for any of these events happening. And if we say, why are we suddenly getting all these cases? Has the genome changed? And that would be a flag for you to say, okay, let's get in and do some whole genome sequencing there. Let's say you're not doing it routinely because you've got too many cases or whatever. You look for differences in behavior, and then you look to see if that can be explained by a change in the genome. And obviously that's what's happened. You know, in India, it was all over, you know, is this really just breakdown of the social restrictions and everyone going on religious festivals and things like that? Or is it more contagious? And obviously the Delta variant became known about. Virulence, there's some talk of that, but we've never really been convinced that any of these have caused more severe disease, other than through its transmissibility, and because there's more people infected, there's more severe disease. And I'm sure we can talk about escape a bit later as well.
Yes, we will. I don't think, would you agree that we're not doing enough gene sequencing in countries to actually monitor this?
Well, it's very heterogeneous, as the world is. You look at countries like Singapore that can do it all, and Australia, New Zealand, if you've got very few cases and a fairly robust health system, then you're in a good position to do it all. UK's been very good at doing it. Africa is obviously very, very challenged in doing this sort of thing. And I must say, that would be my next place of concern. When you've got a lot of transmission happening, and Africa is currently having a surge, you've got a lot of transmission happening and you're not being able to monitor the whole genome sequence, but also monitor for critical disease and clusters, just the epidemiology of it, then don't be surprised if the next variant comes out of a country like that.
Dale, obviously you mentioned that the countries are doing well, like Singapore is doing well and Australia and New Zealand, because they've got small number. How difficult is it to do the genome sequencing, and how expensive can they be?
Difficult. It's not difficult. A typical case, a typical sample might be $100 Singapore dollars type price. So that's why it's easy. The technology is there. That's mobile. But I think ramping it up amongst your other priorities is always going to be the problem. And you could see why in Malaysia, for instance, where there's a lot of cases and a national lockdown, you could argue does whole genome sequencing really offer us much at the moment? Because we've got our interventions at such an extreme, there's nothing else we can do. But look, when the value of whole genome sequencing in connecting clusters and this type of thing is really when the numbers are less. So yes, obviously you should be doing some genome sequencing, but it has to fit into the national capacities and the national priorities of the time.
Yeah. So when we come back, we'll find out. I mean, we're doing all this testing, tracing, isolating, and then, you know, treating people. Where does, you know, genome sequencing actually fall into all of this? And of course, we'll come back and find out what all of this means. How does it impact vaccinations? Because we do know now that in some countries, you know, we don't know if some vaccines actually protect for the Delta variant. And I was just reading that the highly transmissible Delta variant has mutated even further, possibly to a Delta plus variant, and is said to be resistant to certain antibody cocktail treatments. So we'll come back and find out a little bit more about that. If you have a question on genome sequencing, give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Doctor in the House series, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, co-hosting with me. Joining us from Singapore, Dr. Dale Fisher, Professor of Infectious Disease at the National University of Singapore. We are discussing keeping track of COVID-19 variants. We know that there are four distinct variants at the moment. Alpha, the UK variant, Beta, the South African variant, Gamma, the Brazilian one, and Delta, the Indian variant, which is very much of concern at the moment. Have you heard of the new Delta Plus variant yet, Dr. Dale? Is that something we want to talk about today, or we're not very sure about whether this variant really exists or not?
Well, there's a spectrum in the variants. They're being classified as variants under monitoring. There's about 20 of those. There's variants of interest. There's 6 or 7 of those. And then, as you mentioned, there's the four variants of concern. So there is a whole radar of identified variants, and we're watching to see how they perform. And it's obviously the talk of the town at the moment is the Delta, because of its transmissibility. And I think I saw a report that it's 90% of the cases in UK at the moment. So it's certainly got this incredible survival or infectivity advantage.
Okay. we have Sue who's asking, and I don't think you can answer this, but what is hindering the government from increasing genome sequencing? It seems we have enough medical equipment, labs, and people to do this. And, you know, this is really a global discussion at the moment. The question of why countries are not doing enough genome sequencing. Is it some countries say finding the mutations is actually very easy? What about the scale of the data? You know, things like that. What are your thoughts on this?
Look, I can't speak specifically for Malaysia, but I think everything needs to be in context. Many countries are criticised for not doing enough testing. So yes, Obviously testing would be even a higher priority than whole genome sequencing. As I mentioned, I think whole genome sequencing is good for global monitoring. It's good to be able to piece the puzzle together if you want to see, you know, let's say you've got a healthcare worker that got COVID and you might want to know where they got it from. Did they get it from the patient that they were looking at with COVID, or did they get it from a marketplace cluster or something? So you can use whole genome sequencing to understand where that is, where that transmission happened. And if it's the same as the person in the hospital, then they'd say, okay, there's a hospital infection control breach. We need to test more people in the hospital and we need to tighten up our processes there. So I think the most important thing to say when doing whole genome sequencing is what's the importance of the information? How will that affect what you're doing? And again, if you suddenly saw a number of people dying a little bit unexpectedly, then you'd get right in there and do whole genome sequencing there to see if you've identified something new that could be causing a more virulence. So I don't think just do whole genome sequencing for the sake of it. I don't think that. I think there should be maybe a 5%, 10% level. They're the sort of numbers people talk about just to keep an overall feel of what's happening globally. And, of course, many countries can't do any, but and some countries can do more.
Yeah. You know, with some countries hoping to have travel bubbles and things like that, how do you think these variants are going to sort of play out when it comes to opening up borders and things like that?
I think they're separate issues, Mira. Travel bubbles, we used to talk about for opening your borders when there's similar prevalences in both countries. So Singapore tried it with Hong Kong, tried it with Australia, and as soon as they were about to happen, invariably someone would have a cluster and the other country would get cold feet and say, forget it. So Australia and New Zealand have a bubble because they're both eradicated in inverted commas. But I don't think it's the way of the future. I don't think it's a big solution. I think the solution is quite simply in vaccination. And you could have a one-way travel bubble if there's so for instance, I don't think Malaysia should mind people coming from Singapore without because of the different prevalences. But of course, Singapore would mind people coming from Malaysia because you've got a bigger caseload. So in that sense, there's one-way travel bubbles. But I think it's not, as I say, it's not the way to the future. It's just get vaccinated and then we open up our borders and stop worrying about COVID because COVID will become a mild disease in those that are vaccinated.
See, I want to believe that, but I'm not at that stage yet. I can't, probably because I can't see it. You spoke about transmissibility. You spoke about virulence. There's also escape that you spoke about. The vaccines. Let's talk about the vaccines. Do you think there is a chance they could be become ineffective towards some of these variants?
Sorry, you're saying they'll become ineffective on
yes.
those variants?
Yeah.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the discussion is often not very clear. The whole issue of breakthrough cases, they're not really breakthrough cases. We know that a percentage of people that are vaccinated will get disease. And probably of the 100 and I can't remember. There's about 150 people in Singapore that are fully vaccinated that have had disease through our clusters in the last 6 weeks. But only two of them needed oxygen. Not one of them went to ICU, and they're both recovered. So as opposed to 500 plus that are unvaccinated, and nearly 10% of those have needed oxygen or gone to ICU. So this is the different playing field you're creating with the vaccine. Now, will a future variant escape? This is what we must be monitoring for. We monitor for it at a real world level, at a clinical level. And if we start to see, hey, they were vaccinated and got very sick. Oh, here's another person that got vaccinated and is very sick. We're going to start to think, hang on, the vaccine's not working. Now, hopefully in science, we're better than that. We don't need the real world discovery because we can do it through neutralizing antibodies and things like that. And if there's a marker that we can find that shows that the new variant is less responsive to the vaccine, less protected by the vaccine, then hopefully we can realize, okay, we need to do booster jabs or do a modified version of the vaccine urgently. So this is the sort of preclinical and clinical work and observations that we need to do to see if there is a breakthrough, a true breakthrough. So not a breakthrough of asymptomatic and mild disease. We know that happens, but a breakthrough of severe disease, intensive care disease, deaths. That's what we have to stop. If the future is everyone's vaccinated and a few people get a cold or something like that, then there's no reason for us to do anything. We just go back to life as it was, making sure everyone's vaccinated.
Dale, I mean, we read reports to say that certain vaccines have certain protection rate against certain variants. What does that actually mean?
This is where I think it's not very clear. Are they referring to severe disease, which generally they are, or at least symptomatic disease? This is not clear. They'll say, oh, it's, you know, still 85% effective or something like that. Actually, it's still, our experience in Singapore is it's still 100% effective against severe disease. Because we're getting the Delta variant, but we're seeing, you know, a reasonable amount of symptomatic disease, but it's not severe. So the severity needs to be brought into the conversation of the protection, the ability of the vaccine to protect.
Okay, with that in mind, is it fair to say that for all those who are vaccinated, regardless of what vaccine you had, you are protected against most of the current known variants from death or a critical disease? Is that fair to say that?
It's not a bad summary, but it's going to be watch this space, because you remember the AstraZeneca vaccine in South Africa had bad results against that variant.
So
it will matter which vaccine and which variant. But at the moment, I think it's safe to say that I haven't seen data on all the vaccines, but certainly most of the vaccines seem very effective against the Delta variant. And certainly against severe disease.
Yeah. So let me just go through. South Africa suspended the use of AstraZeneca in February after trials found that the vaccine's efficacy was under 25% for the Beta variant. And a recent study by Public Health England found that two doses of the Pfizer or the AstraZeneca vaccines were more than 90% effective against hospitalization from the Delta variant and comparable to vaccine effectiveness against hospitalization from the Alpha variant. So it keeps changing, because in the same study, Public Health England found that one dose is 17% less effective at protecting people from the Delta variant compared to the Alpha variant. So do you not think that this is just going to be continuous? It's going to be a work in progress. We are going to have to tweak and move along, you know, as we find out more about this virus.
You know, Mira, we have trouble keeping up too. So I don't know how the general public can keep up with this. And by and large, if you can be comfortable, then just go with what the authorities say. Let them do the work for you, because it's tremendously difficult to keep up with this. But I'm glad the facts you just stated are pretty much what I said, that it does vary between variants. And as you say, the South African one seemed to have problems. Luckily, we don't have that variant here. But you're right, new variants, future vaccines, it is a space to watch. This is why many people do argue that there's a good chance we're going to need boosters and boosters, either because the first vaccine schedule that you had wore off, although we're not really seeing that. What we're seeing more is this variant escape. And if Pfizer is, the numbers I've seen are like 10% less effective, but again, still very effective against severe disease, then is the next variant that comes out of Africa going to be lower?
Yeah.
And the good thing is, with the technology, with the vaccines, they can actually tweak it and start creating a new version, very similar to flu, and we wouldn't need to go through all the trials. We wouldn't have to wait a year. We certainly don't do that with flu vaccines every 6 months.
Okay, we'll come back finally and conclude with whether or not, let's talk about the booster shots and see whether or not that's something that's playing on my mind. A lot of people who've completed the two doses of the vaccines, what happens after this for them? What do they do after this? Does that mean, how long are they protected for? That's coming up next. If you have a question for Dr. Dale Fisher, we are discussing genomic surveillance of COVID-19. Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018 789 8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivisodhi. If you have just joined us, we are discussing keeping track of COVID-19 variants. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in our Doctor in the House series. Joining us from Singapore, Dr. Dale Fisher, professor of infectious diseases at the National University of Singapore. You know, Professor Dale, the reason we're asking you so many of these questions, and I'm slowly and ever slowly coming down to this conclusion that, as you said very right, accurately just now, just listen to your government, listen to what the basics that you need to do, which is get vaccinated. Don't worry too much. There's so much information coming out. We're inundated. We get so alarmed by some of these headlines, sometimes with very little context, because we don't know the backstory. We don't know the science. We don't understand a lot of things that's happening. It can be overwhelming. Let's talk about the possibility of booster shots. Dr. Dale, where do you stand on this? Do we know whether people need booster shots after the two doses or one dose of the vaccine?
Yeah, but just to go back on your last point, I don't want to be misinterpreted as I know a lot of people like to challenge what authorities say and what government says, and that's okay if you want to understand. I'm just saying the information is getting more and more technical. Yeah. And the effort needed to keep up and make insightful decisions, in many ways, it's easier just to say, can someone please tell me what the right thing to do is? So yeah, I think that's a good message to send, although I want to send it in the right way. We've gone a year and a half now with a vaccine based on the original strain from Wuhan, the original viruses from Wuhan. So, and the vaccine that we've got is still very good. There are no problems with the vaccine now. And if we stop now, then we'd go, okay, let's just keep using this vaccine. But I do believe there will come a time when we just say, look, it's slipping too much. It's the new virus strains. Are too different from the initial one that we based our vaccines on, and it's time to do some tweaks. What I believe is that it won't be as often as flu, which is every 6 months, 12 months, there's a new northern or southern hemisphere version. Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're very different, but there is a new version every 6 months. I don't think we're going to go there. I think it's more looking at the rate now. I would say it's probably going to be every 3 or 4 years, which will have challenges because people will forget how horrible this was, just like people can forget how horrible polio is or something like that. That's the problem with vaccine preventable diseases. You do such a good job, people forget how horrible the disease is. So let's remember how horrible this was, and when it is time to get revaccinated, which would be my prediction, then let's make sure we do it.
Okay. So booster shots, do you foresee we will need one, in a year's time perhaps, 6 months, 3 months, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm saying it could be a 3 or 4 yearly cycle, something like that.
Okay. All right. So we just need to watch how far the gene of this virus actually strays from the original.
That's right. How far it just keeps mutating and drifting away from the original, and when it's different enough and starting to allow enough escape, then, as you say, 10%, 17%, but when it's got escape from severe disease, then we definitely need to do a new one. And I'm sure the authorities and the vaccine companies will be ahead of us on this.
Okay.
Dale, I seem to have an impression from picking up what you said earlier on, that perhaps 2-3 years from now, for all of us, if we're vaccinated and perhaps with that necessity for a bit of a booster, and then COVID-19 perhaps may become just a minor flu. Is that a wrong impression that I have that detected from what you said earlier on?
Yeah, so short of a mutation that just becomes completely mild and ineffective or non-transmissible or something, short of some sort of incredible genetic thing that sees it die out, I think it will just fit into the landscape of respiratory illnesses. Obviously, there's some non-respiratory things, but it'll fit into that landscape. We will see people that aren't vaccinated continue to get severe disease, which is why it's important that we continue to look on treatments. We're still not very good at treating it, at least from an antiviral point of view. And I think there'll be probably a few exceptions of people where the vaccine wasn't effective. I think there's always exceptions, but I think we'll see little cases and clusters, but we'll never, if we find that the booster shots are the way to go, providing we keep up with that, then I don't think we'll have to relive this, the economic and social effects that this disease has brought to the world.
With that in mind, how much do you think the variants or the future variants perhaps going to topple that ideal? And also, will this be overcome by genomic sequencing?
Yeah, I think we've got the tools. I think we have the sensing around the world. As I say, I'm still worried about countries that have got a lot of transmission, whether it's Philippines or Indonesia or Africa, but countries with a lot of transmission and not a great capacity to do whole genome sequencing and even basic epidemiology. I still think we're vulnerable to variants coming out of there.
Dale, what about the fact that, some countries, even Malaysia, is already considering perhaps, or we're exploring the implementation of mixing and matching vaccines? You have any thoughts on that?
It's that same question before. There's so many permutations. But what we're seeing trickle out is almost anything, as long as you get a couple of jabs. That they do seem to stimulate adequately. So we're not seeing that, you had the mRNA and then you followed it up with Sinovac. I mean, haven't necessarily seen every combination tested, but what it looks like at the moment is a second dose of an alternative vaccine seems to work.
Will it confuse our immune system?
Well, no, actually. I mean, you're still feeding up, you're still tricking the immune system into thinking that the virus is there.
Yeah.
So whether you're using bits of mRNA or whether you're using the whole virus that's been killed, such as the inactivated viruses, it's the same mechanism. You're still presenting pieces of virus so that the body learns to react to it.
So it will mount a response either way, and that's what you want.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think this disease will change individuals and how they behave in the future from a public health perspective?
I've been on a lot of outbreak responses in my life, and so many times we've said, whether it's Ebola or influenza or whatever, just imagine when the outbreak's over. This has been an opportunity and we've got all this infection control better, all these public health measures are better. And the sad truth from my observations is that generally things tend to go back to where they were. I hope that's not so. I think there are some lessons and some practices that could well survive. I think things like telemedicine and telecommuting, I think they will survive. I don't think people will fly across the world for a one-day meeting as much as they used to. I think flexible working hours, I think people might feel more comfortable sleeping in and then working late at night to get the work done. I don't think people will go to work coughing and spluttering anymore and people saying, oh, isn't he great for coming to work? So I think if that person comes up and he's sitting in your room blowing his nose, then you say, get out of my go home. I don't want to see you for a week. So I think some things will change. I think depending on the country, some communities have become unified. Some have become a bit segregated, but I think many countries have sort of very proud of their actions and how they've responded to the needs. So, and I think individuals will appreciate more of what they've got, and you know, such as their job or their career or whatever. I think their relationships. So I think there'll be some benefits, but probably not as many as we could have.
Yeah. Well, you'll always be a superstar. We won't forget that. All the infectious diseases people, epidemiologists, public health experts, all of whom, have become rock stars over the last 15, 16 months.
I've got a feeling that'll go back to normal.
We won't. We'll try not to forget. George, would you have a message?
Dale, I mean, the last 12 months, the world has been a very different place. The last time we spoke, as you can recall, we talked about detecting COVID virus in the Singapore sewage system down the causeway, and also how the virus can be transmitted via chicken wings from Brazil and so on and so forth. Clearly, 12 months later, it's a very, very different world and it's moving very fast. If I have one thing that I take away from this, I think that if we all work together and accept the vaccine and don't have so much hesitancy and skepticism, I really think to look at the world like how you put it, in the future, if all of us are vaccinated, COVID-19 can just be a mild flu. And that's the day I hope to see in the next 12 months when we speak again.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us. Dale, would you have a message for us?
I think we used to say when it came to vaccine, do it for your community, do it for your loved ones. And more we're saying, do it for yourself. Eventually COVID will be running quite free because we'll be opening up our borders, we'll be taking off our masks. And if you're not vaccinated, you're going to get COVID.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us. It's the, breath of fresh air. Thank you, especially just before the weekend. Thank you for joining us. Dr. Dale Fisher, Professor of Infectious Diseases, National University of Singapore, and of course, Dr. George Lee, Consultant Neurologist, my co-host in this week's Doctor in the House series, Keeping Track of COVID-19 Variants on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.